accession number 18574, reel 3.
So, what kind of effect did the loss of the Ark Royal have on you and your shipmates?
I think everybody was initially in a state of shock. It had been sunk so many times by Lord Haw-Haw, and now it was for real.
So, you lost everything, did you?
Yep.
How did they treat you aboard HMS Legion?
Oh, we were only on her for a matter of 5 or 6 hours, I suppose, really. You were just standing there, shoulder to shoulder, tightly packed, waiting to be dropped off somewhere in Gib. And I went to the Maidstone, which was a submarine depot ship, for a couple of days, and then came home from Gib, and couple of weeks leave, and then 825 Squadron with Esmond the CO reformed, or started to reform, at Leon Solent, and the first three aircraft that came out of stores for us to pick up needed to be calibrated for their radar equipment, and initially, my number two in the squadron was detailed to do this job, but he'd never done radar calibration. So I saw Esmond and we changed. He stayed down at Lee and I went up to Campbelltown in Scotland with the first three aircraft to do these ASV polar diagrams. And of course, that was the time when the other six aircraft, as they came out of store, they went to Manston and attacked the Sharnos and Nisenor in the channel, and all six were shot down.
So you were lucky.
I was very lucky. Very lucky. And then the squadron eventually got together again, and we went to Thorny Island, remembering that we got six new crews because we lost six crews virtually, and we went to Thorny Island and we laid mines in Le Havre and Cherbourg. We were there for, I don't know, a couple of months, I suppose, and we lost two aircraft on that episode. And then three of us were sent to HMS Avenger to do the Russian convoy PQ-18.
Do you have any memories of the mine laying episodes?
Not anything which was out of the ordinary, really. We just took off from Thorny Island with the mine and went to Cherbourg or Le Havre or wherever it was going, laid the mine and came back, hopefully avoiding any trouble.
This was flying from?
Thorny Island.
What were the facilities like there?
Very good. Very good. Another incident of the way the different services operate, and when you come together, you experience some difficulties. All of the tags in the squadron, they were all leading hands, which is the equivalent of corporals, whereas in the RAF everybody who flew was a sergeant, and I managed, because they were crew operating, and I managed to get my tags into the sergeant's mess, which was quite different from the usual sort of thing. And you have another squadron operating from the same airfield at Thorny Island whose tags were not in the sergeant's mess, and you can imagine the chit-chat that sort of thing resulted in. But it was the RAF looked after their air crews very, very well. Better than we were looked after on carriers.
In what specific ways?
Well, food, meals when you come back from an operation, that didn't happen in the Navy.
And so you were just about to tell me about Arctic Convoy, was it PQ-18 you said?
Yeah, PQ-18, yeah. On the Avenger. And we had three swordfish and I can't remember how many Hurricanes we had, but we had Hurricanes as fighters. And that was, I don't know, but I suppose for a period of about 5 days, I would put down as being the most horrific 5 days for me of the war. And I can only take my hat off to those sailors who did that type of convoy not once, but did it repeatedly. The loss of, to see 13 ships go down in those waters where you don't last in the water for more than a minute is terrible. Yeah. Mm. And we were doing constant anti-submarine patrols, and we would do a couple of hours or more, say 3 hours altogether in the air, and then 3 hours on standby and 3 hours rest. And we did that for, I don't know, 4 or 5 days, and we were kept going by Benzedrine tablets, which did keep you going. But when you got back and they all came home, you knew that your body had been subjected to something which was out of the ordinary.
Were there any unpleasant side effects?
It's just that you felt dreadful for a matter of, I don't know, a week or so. Or at least I did.
You mean a headache?
Yeah, that's right. Mm.
Who recommended the Benzedrine tablets?
No idea.
Were they just official issue?
Yes, oh yes. Yes, it was all official.
Who were you crewed with then?
I can't remember.
Doesn't matter if you can't remember.
I can't remember. Because we used to swap around anyway.
What was flying from Avenger like?
More hazardous than it was flying in those operating conditions than it was from big carriers, because the much smaller operating space. And her not capable of I think she could do 18 knots, the Avenger. But you could get off with depth charges, no problem. But if there wasn't much of a wind, you had to drop your depth charges before you got back on. So, and I think too that you, the longer it went on, the more sort of operationally fatigued you became. And I think that's where, you know, you might do a heavy landing where perhaps you normally wouldn't, and all that entails in trying to get the aircraft back into service. You know, it was really hard work for the people concerned.
Because of damage done to it.
Yeah, and I think the captain of the Avenger was a commander, and in the end he sent the Avenger home saying that the crews were too tired to carry on or too tired to be of much use. I don't think he thought... His was a case where he didn't think much of the swordfish anyway. Which is rather, you find that out afterwards. With hindsight, it's not very commendable, I think, for somebody to have said at that time that when you've been flying your guts out that you haven't done any good. And we knew we'd done good. We knew we kept the subs down. We knew we kept them out of the way. But then you saw subs because there were plenty of them. As indeed there were plenty of aircraft attacking you continuously.
What typically would be your sight of a U-boat?
What
would happen when you saw a U-boat? What can you describe what you would see?
Well, it depends how close you were to there. They would have a Blohm & Voss aircraft circling the convoy as well. I mean, you used to go around together, but we wouldn't get near them because they had 0.5 cannons and we only had 303, so they would have had us before we got anywhere near them, so you didn't have anything to do with the aircraft. Equally, if the submarine was underneath that aircraft, then you would just report it. But if you could do an attack without endangering yourself with the guy that's up there, then you would do that as well. It was to size up the situation as you actually saw it.
So
but you had the destroyer screens, who you could con the destroyer screens into the position of the subs, and they would be in there dropping their depth charges. So a combination of the aircraft spotting them and the destroyer screens attacking the submarines kept, for the most part, kept a lot of them down, because most of the damage was not done by subs, it was done by torpedo aircraft, Heinkels. And they would come in, I think the maximum torpedo formation was 42 Heinkels, each carrying two torpedoes. And they were, some of them were concentric torpedoes, and they dropped them and they went in ever-decreasing circles. So that if they missed the huge convoy, and we've got a convoy of, I don't know, 80, 90 ships, you know, torpedoes circling, and lots of them, they're going to hit something. And if you see an ammunition ship go up, you only want to see it once.
What about the effectiveness of Swordfish versus Sir Heinkel?
No contest. The only thing that a string bag had, which was an advantage, was that its slow speed and its ability to sort of turn in its own length. Again, with correct crew cooperation, you could take avoiding action and probably get away with it.
Did most of the losses seem to be to the aircraft or to the U-boats on PQ-18?
No, the losses were the ships in the convoy. I can't remember how many we shot down, but our fighters shot down quite a number of Heinkels. And a couple of subs were sunk. But I can't remember offhand the exact details. It's in the book, though.
But what I meant was, were most of the ships lost to aircraft attack or U-boat attack?
Aircraft.
Why were the U-boats less effective?
Because we were keeping them down. But if you're attacked by torpedo bombers and high-level bombers at the same time, a synchronized attack, they've got a much, much better chance and were more successful. In fact, you've got to admire the tenacity with which those Heinkel crews, in fact, carried out their job. They came through all hell of a fire. And on one occasion, they came in so close. On one occasion, a chap actually dropped his torpedo on a ship, rather than in the drink.
Did you see that?
Yeah, I didn't actually see it, but it's reported in the convoy sort of reports.
So, with PQ18, you were operating between towards Bear Island.
That's right, up towards Murmansk, bound for Murmansk. The convoy was going to Murmansk, and we turned away and came back home when we were about, I don't know, a day and a half out from Murmansk, I suppose. The rest of the fleet went on.
Was there any evidence of the Russians coming out to help?
A lot of controversy about that. There was some help, but not the amount of help which was expected when they got nearer to Murmansk. But we were on our way home then.
And after PQ18, what happened to you then?
I can't remember.
You've put 27th of September 1942, OWL.
Yeah, well, I went to various air stations and the squadron was jigging around. And then I left the squadron. I'd seen so many of my tags had been lost and they'd been replaced, and I'd been operational for, I don't know, a couple of years or something. And I suppose the powers that be thought it was time I had a break. And so I went back to Arbroath, and went back on to training again, training observers. And I was chief in the Naval Air Signal School at Arbroath when voice communication was just beginning to become much more operative. So I was involved in that for a while, and then I was drafted to another aircraft carrier, a new aircraft carrier in Belfast. HMS Glory, and that was about the time when VE Day occurred, but the Glory was going out to Japan to do her stuff out there, and I got to Sydney in the Glory, and they dropped the atom bomb and virtually the war was over. And this was the time when I had to make my mind up whether I was going to stay in the Navy or leave. And I weighed things up and I decided to leave, which rather shook everybody because I was sort of Navy to the core. But I didn't see much future for tags in the Navy. That was largely because, I don't know, I didn't like the lack of crew cooperation, and I never felt that I was really a really cooperative crew member. You sort of did what you were told, but I missed, in my own mind, I was missing that job satisfaction, really, I suppose you'd call it. And so I left, and after a short excursion into civilian life in a radio shop, I got my flight radio officer's license and I flew with BEA, and that was a much more rewarding task, pioneering all the new civil aircraft routes throughout Europe with Dakotas and Vikings in the beginning, and then later on the Ambassador and the Vanguard and the Viscount and the Trident. It was all a marvellous experience.
What job did you have with the civil aircraft?
Doing the same thing. I was a radio officer.
But coming back to HMS Glory, did you have any operational experience with that ship?
Well, I was not flying. I was not on flying duties. I was headquarters staff, looking after the training of other tags that were on the carrier with other squadrons, and they did a couple of ops on the way through the Indian Ocean. But nothing much. And we went to Perth, called in at Perth, and then went round to Sydney, and the bomb dropped, and that was the end of the war.
How did you feel when you heard the news of the atom bombs?
Well, the fact that it stopped the war was great, and I had survived.
How do you feel now, looking back from 1998, about having served with the Fleet Air Arm in the Second World War?
Oh, I was pleased, very pleased to have done that. In fact, since the war, in BEA, I became a training manager, and I had at one stage I had 172 instructors, and I would go to Leon Solent to recruit radio officers and to recruit instructors. And all of my friends, even to this day, are naval rather than civil aviation, although a lot of them were both in civil aviation and in the Fleet Air Arm, because I'd recruited them into the into BEA.
I know you're an official of the Telegraphist Air Gunners Association, but I hadn't realised that you actually started it up.
Well, I was the first chairman of the Telegraphist Air Gunners Association. And I suppose over the years, I've been chairman something like 14 times, and I've been editor and secretary. So I really know what makes it tick. And this is why I know all the people, practically all the people that are left. Originally, there were, overall, from 1922, when the branch was started, there were a total of something like 3,000 tags. Now, of those, about 600 got written off during the war. I suppose a similar amount, 600, have died from natural causes since the war. And now there are about 500 and just over 500 that are left. And we are a very strong association. And when you bear in mind that the average age is now probably something like 75, we meet very regularly. I've got a lunch, for instance, here, a Christmas lunch here, for which I've got 45 booked. So we keep together. That's the East Anglian branch. We've got a branch in Charlie Hawthorne, who you saw and interviewed. He was chairman of the northern branch, and then we've got a southern branch and a midland branch. But we're very, very close, very closely knit, association.